Okay, well, so this is a an obvious question for the... For the half of the audience coming from the biophysics program. But part of the reason I'm here is to let you in on an inside secret, and that is, this is an equally good question for the other half of the room. In fact, you should be a little bit careful about who you call an M-theorist in the halls of the ITP. You might provoke an identity crisis. So we don't know what M-theory is. We've just got pieces of that. And one of the big pieces is, of course, string theory.
Excuse me, what does the M stand for?
I'll get to that. Okay, we'd like to know what the M stands for, is the short answer. We have some ideas. Ask me that after the, towards the end. Okay, so what I'd like to do in this talk is give you some of the motivations for believing that there is this very interesting looking theory. And I'll give you an overview of some of the recent developments that have led up to the state of things as they stand now. And I'll also outline some of the questions that we're confronting. So the agenda that provokes our explorations is to really carry the reductionist principle to its extreme. We're looking for a fundamental theory of all physics. I don't like the name theory of everything, so I'll use theory of all physics instead. And in some ways, it seems that we're quite close, but in other ways, it seems like we're quite far from that goal. But I'll outline some of the hints that we've unearthed. So the idea is to go to shorter and shorter distances and reduce to more and more elementary constituents. So let's start out with a, let's pick a starting point and take a few steps along the reductionist road. So I'll pick a molecule at random, for example, DNA. Your average everyday random molecule for half of the audience. And so DNA...
As opposed to those of us who aren't made of DNA.
Okay, so DNA... The physics of DNA takes place on scales of order 10 to the minus 7 centimeters or so. That's approximately the width of a DNA molecule, or larger. But we're interested in more fundamental constituents, so let's take a, one of the carbon atoms that is part of the structure of this molecule, DNA. And let's imagine magnifying that, and if we magnify it, we learn that it has a description as an electron cloud surrounding a heavy and very small central object, the nucleus. And of course, the approximate scale that we're interested in here is not that much smaller than the scale corresponding to the size, to the width of DNA. It's of order 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. And on this scale, the nucleus is point-like, but we can imagine blowing that up, magnifying even further. And if we magnify even further, then we discover that the nucleus is comprised of more elementary objects, the protons and neutrons. I won't draw all of them, but that's a few of them in carbon. And the characteristic distance scale the size, approximate size of the nucleus is somewhere in the vicinity of 10 to the minus 12 centimeters. So we've blown up by a factor of maybe 10,000 or so. And of course, when, in elementary physics, when we try to go to shorter and shorter distances. The way we accomplish that is by going to higher and higher energies. So it's typical to also characterize the scale on which you are working by the energy which you have to go to probe it. So this is of order 1 over 10 MeV. There's this inverse relation because higher energies lead to shorter distances. Okay, so here we have our nucleus, protons and neutrons. But of course, there's more to the story than that. If you take a proton and magnify it, you discover that it is made out of even smaller objects, the so-called quarks. And a proton consists of two up quarks and a down quark bound together by a force known as the strong force, which I'll say more about in a moment. And the characteristic distance scale there is, not that much less than that of the nucleus. And likewise, the neutrons are also made out of quarks, just a different combination of these elementary objects, or elementary so far. The neutron is two down quarks and an up quark. So it turns out that all of, as we see here, we've deconstructed a molecule and broken it down into constituents that are just very simple building blocks, quarks and electrons. And all of ordinary matter indeed can be thought of as being comprised of these basic constituents, the up quark and the down quark. And these carry a charge, sort of a generalization of electric charge that is responsible for their binding into the nucleus. So I'll denote those charges red, blue, and green. And then we have also the electron. And then finally, one other not so obvious particle, but very ubiquitous, is the electron neutrino. These are extremely common. There are many of them streaming through your body at this very instant. And those are the constituents of ordinary matter. But this is not all that there is in physics. Some number of years ago, we started to discover high-energy cosmic rays, and now we routinely make in high-energy, in accelerators, we make extraordinary matter. Other varieties of quarks, the so-called charm quark and strange quark, which also come in three colors, and the top and bottom quark. The top, of course, was fairly recently discovered. And likewise, there are corresponding particles, the cousins of the electron, the mu particle and the tau, and their corresponding neutrinos. And when this structure began to be unearthed with the discovery of the muon, an obvious question was asked by the physicist Rabi, who said, who ordered the muon? Okay, so these are the basic constituents of matter as we know them, and these are all examples of what are known as fermions. These are basically particles that obey the Fermi exclusion principle. You can't put two of them in the same quantum state. Okay, now let's talk about the forces. Well, actually, I'll put that over here. Talk a little bit more about the forces of nature. So, of course, you're quite familiar. Again, I'm aiming this talk at the biophysicists and the biologists in the audience. You're quite familiar with one of the forces, and that is the force of electromagnetism. And a basic paradigm in elementary particle physics is that forces are mediated by exchange of particles. So, for example, if you are interested in the force between two electrons, that is thought of as and described as being mediated by exchange of a photon. And there is a probability for the photon to be, well, to interact with the electron, and that is basically the electric charge. Okay, so up here I'll make a little table. Associated with the electromagnetic force, we have the photon. And then I've already mentioned another force, the one that binds the quarks into protons and neutrons and the protons and neutrons together into the nucleus. That's the so-called strong force. And that is likewise carried by particles which we call gluons. Then there is another force which is involved in certain radioactive decays, the weak force, and that's carried by the W plus and minus and Z bosons, which have relatively recently, in the scheme of things, been discovered. And then finally, there's another force that we all know about because it keeps us from floating off into space, and that's gravity. And that's mediated by gravitons. These are all examples of, these particles are all examples of objects known as gauge bosons. The boson moniker, indicating that these are things that can, in some sense, condense. Okay, now there's one other component of physics as we more or less know it today, although this is a component that we're still missing some of the information about. Ordinary gauge bosons, like the one you're most familiar with, the photon, are massless. That's the usual story for gauge bosons. They're always massless. But it turns out that the gauge bosons associated with the weak force are quite massive. That's one of the reasons that the weak force is so weak and that it took us so long to discover these objects by making them. We had to go to very high energies. And so we need to understand why the gauge bosons of the weak force are different from those of the electromagnetic force. And the basic idea is that these things are heavy because they have interactions with another kind of particle, which goes by the name of the Higgs boson. Roughly. By the way, I encourage questions if people have them at any time. And indeed, there exists a unified theory of the electromagnetic and weak forces together, much in a similar spirit to our earlier discovery that electricity and magnetism are parts of the same thing. And this unified theory goes by the name of the symmetry structure that describes it, SU2 cross, well, it's an SU2 cross U1 theory. I won't try to explain that right now for biologists, but that's a name. And the Higgs boson is responsible for a symmetry breaking. The weak bosons and the photon are very much initially on the same footing, but the Higgs boson leads to a breaking of that symmetry so that the photon turns out to be massless and these things end up being very massive. This is responsible for symmetry breaking.
Is this still a hypothetical particle or it has been found already?
This has not yet been observed. So that is the sense in which, well, we're not certain it exists. Something that plays its role exists. But we don't, well, we haven't completely nailed that down. And that's one of the next interesting things that we hope will happen in experimental physics. Okay, so what I have just described, and I'll put in a big box, goes by the name of the Standard Model. And the Standard Model is a very good description of much of what we see in nature. And it's clearly a very beautiful structure, but it's not beautiful enough. And it's pretty clear in particular that it's not fundamental and that there are some problems that indicate that. So let me spell out what some of those problems are. So the first problem is that the standard model is quite complicated or baroque. We have a large number of different kinds of particles with different properties, and also a number of different interactions with different properties. But yet we have hints of an underlying symmetry and structure behind those. It's somewhat analogous to the situation where the periodic table was being discovered. We had a number of complicated things, but we saw that there were underlying regularities and symmetries. And that suggested an underlying structure. A second and related objection to this as a fundamental theory of all physics is that it has roughly 20 free parameters that are needed to specify the physics of this model. And that's a lot of free parameters for a truly fundamental theory. A third problem...
Excuse me, why did you say roughly 20?
It depends on how you count. there are certain... It depends on what you think of as being a free parameter, in other words. Counting is all the same. It's what you count and what you don't. Okay. So, but examples of these free parameters are, well, roughly speaking, the masses of all these particles, the strengths, the coupling constants corresponding to all these forces, and various other things, so-called mixing angles that tell us how these things decay into these things, and so on. Okay, a third problem is that the standard model as it stands requires fine tunings of some of these parameters. Let me give you an example. This is an example of something that is often not really taken to be a free parameter of the standard model, so an example of an ambiguity in how you count. A parameter that is relevant for this discussion is called lambda, and it's essentially the weight of empty space. Now, we know that in the context of particle physics, quantum mechanics in particular, empty space is not so empty. You have zero-point oscillations in all of the fields, say the photon field, and those give you a zero-point energy. And that energy means that empty space weighs something, and that will, since gravity couples to mass, to weight, that means that empty space can essentially gravitate. And an important question is understanding how naive estimates of how big that weight is can be reconciled with the observation that this weight of empty space, otherwise known as the cosmological constant, is observed to be so small. We have a very large universe where empty space is not, in any sense, strongly gravitating, but naive estimates would lead to the conclusion that empty space very strongly gravitates. So that's one example. And another example is the mass of this so-called Higgs particle, which typically you would estimate to be very large, and you have to choose your free parameters, one relation between your free parameters, very carefully in order to arrange that mass is a reasonable value to give the observed masses of the W and Z bosons. Okay, and then finally there's a fourth issue, and this is the outstanding problem, in my opinion, of the physics of the last century. That is the problem of reconciling quantum mechanics with gravity.
Steve, it's hard for them to see in the back if it's down that low.
Oh, okay. Problem is I need to make a table. So, let me see. Well, okay, I won't go any lower.
Well,
let me see. I can move the whole thing up. This will just take a second.
Just move gravity in time.
Well, okay. Warp gravity. Okay. So the fourth problem is that of gravity. Naively, when you combine quantum mechanics with gravity, you encounter an infinite number of very nasty divergences. And in addition, there are a number of very difficult conceptual issues, like those of black holes. What happens inside a black hole? And of cosmology, and in particular, the initial state of the universe. So these are all questions we would expect a theory of all physics to address. So this leads us to the conclusion that the standard model is not the whole story, although it's very nice, and that we need to look for extensions of the standard model. Now, an obvious possibility is to just carry the kind of process that we were talking about in the beginning of the talk one step further and to imagine that there's another level of compositeness, that things are, like quarks and so on, are made out of smaller things. Now, people have tried various ways of building theories that describe composite quarks and electrons and so on. And these have not met with a lot of success, at least without a huge amount of work. And in particular, it's difficult to find agreement with some of the very precise measurements that we are now making at high-energy accelerators. And so I'm not going to really talk about this avenue. A lot of people in the field believe that something else is going on. But I should mention that. We have, in essence, seen that the particles I've enumerated are point-like to of order 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, so we push things considerably further than we started with. But they could be composite at shorter distances. We're not certain. But another possibility that looks much more attractive is the following. And that is the possibility that there is more unification in nature along the lines of the unification of electricity and magnetism and the strong and the electromagnetic and the weak force. And this class of theory goes by the name of grand unified theories. And let me just draw a picture that gives some hint of what's going on. If you look at the various coupling constants, like the electric charge, that describe the strengths of these interactions, and you plot those coupling constants, now I'll call them G, as a function of the log of the distance, or the log of the energy, you find that those coupling constants are not constant. Empty space, because of all those fluctuations of the fields, behaves like a dielectric medium. It leads to either screening or anti-screening. So if you go to shorter and shorter distances, the electromagnetic force gets, this is sort of a cartoon version. Really, the U1, but let's call it just the electromagnetic force, gets stronger and stronger at shorter and shorter distances, whereas the other parts, for example, the strong force, and roughly speaking, the force carried by these guys, gets stronger at shorter distances. And it turns out that if you follow those trajectories, they all come extremely close to meeting at a distance scale that's of order 10 to the minus 31 or so centimeters. And so that's a hint that maybe we ought to think of particles as being point-like all the way down to such distances and really trust our calculations, and that something different happens, namely all of these forces become part of some more symmetric force at these very short distances or very high energies. Now, of course, another question is what happens to gravity? And if you look at the gravitational force, it does something more like that. And actually, it comes pretty close to meeting this intersection point on the scale of things, but not quite. Okay, so grand unified theories actually address some of these problems. So in the context of grand unified theories, we partially solved the problem of the standard model being baroque because basically, for example, the electron and the quarks are seen as part of a more symmetric structure.
Why did you show gravity so strong?
What's that?
Why did you show gravity so strong?
I didn't understand the question.
Gravity looks strong on your...
Oh, yeah.
It's upside down.
It's upside down, probably. Yeah, yeah, no, that's right. Gravity goes very weak. I'm sorry, I'm plotting 1 over g squared. Gravity goes very weak at long distances, so it should have been like that. Okay, so the quarks and the electron and so on are unified into a more symmetric structure. So we start to see some of the underlying structure emerging from something else. And likewise, we reduce the number of free parameters. For example, we relate the strengths of the couplings here. But we still have the problem of fine-tuning, and we have not confronted any of the fundamental issues in gravity. And that leads us to think that we ought to be looking for some more new ideas. And another new idea is that of supersymmetry. And one way to motivate supersymmetry is to look seriously at this third problem, that of the fine-tuning. And as I said, the quantum fluctuations in fields like the photon field lead to corrections to the weight of empty space. And if you look at those corrections, you see that the corrections due to bosonic fields and the corrections due to fermionic fields come in with the opposite sign. And likewise, when you're looking at corrections to the Higgs mass schematically. And so this suggests the following idea, that for each of the particles in nature, say for the neutrinos and the electrons, which are fermionic, there are corresponding bosonic superpartners which enter in and contribute, make an opposite contribution, so everything adds up to zero or very nearly zero. So these things are known as superpartners, and the symmetry that relates the fermionic particles we see with the bosonic particles, the superpartners, is known as supersymmetry. Likewise, there should be superpartners of all of the gauge bosons. But now an obvious question is, well, this may save you mathematically, but where are the superpartners? We don't actually see them in nature. We don't see them in our high-energy experiments. And so if supersymmetry is a fundamental theory, which it could well be, somehow it must be at low energies a broken symmetry in the same way that, for example, electromagnetism and the weak force emerge after breaking down some more fundamental symmetry. Now, in fact, this is a very interesting and exciting part of the field right now, because if you go out and look on the bulletin board out there, there is a press release from a recent measurement done at Brookhaven. Well, the measurement's been done a while ago, but the data analysis is recent, arguing that we may have just indirectly seen some of these superpartners to the known particles. And so we may be on the verge, well, we may have just discovered supersymmetry. We will see. Back to our table of addressing objections to the standard model. Well, supersymmetry does not help with the baroqueness problem, because for every particle, you introduce another particle. So in a sense, it's even worse. Likewise, the number of free parameters problem is much worse, because there are many more free parameters characterizing the couplings of all these particles. The fine-tuning problem you've partially solved. The reason I say partially is because this supersymmetry breaking means that still you have to, you need some fine-tuning much less, but you still need some large amount of fine-tuning to agree with observations. And then finally, you still haven't tackled gravity.
Steve, could I ask how the measurement or non-measurement of the Higgs 10 years from now is going to impact your table?
Impact this table?
Yeah.
It won't. It could give us more hints, for example, of how we should follow this and so on. More hints of the underlying structure. We may discover something slightly different than the Higgs as we, you know, as we sort of minimally guess it to be. So it could have, it could shift various of these issues by affecting sort of the lower end of the energy scale. But we, you know, it really depends on what we see, is the short answer.
But I guess what I say is you're about to present the M version, I guess, in the next column. And the question is, does the existence or not or measurement of the Higgs impact whatsoever anything going on?
Well, yeah, certainly. Well, certainly, for example, if we don't see the Higgs, if we see something complicated, like, say, some composite structure, then it's all out the window. Or at least we have to rethink it all. And that these compositeness ideas actually, you know, postulate, for example, that the Higgs is in some sense made out of some more fundamental thing. So that's something that we might be on the alert for, or we might be on the alert for extra Higgses, or, you know, other things we might discover at the same time as the Higgs. So any of that could modify the story significantly. Tom?
Maybe it should be added that supersymmetric theories tend to predict relatively low mass Higgs boson.
That's also.
Whereas these other theories tend to predict a much higher mass Higgs boson, if you see one at all. And so if we find a low mass Higgs boson, that'll be an indication for supersymmetry. And of course, there was a measurement at LEP which might have actually seen it, but they don't have enough statistics.
Yeah, I would not call that a measurement, at least what I saw.
Yes, I agree.
Okay. So, so that's supersymmetry and grand unified theories. And the obvious next step is actually to take those and combine them into a combined theory with supersymmetry and grand unification, and take advantage of the good properties of both. So, for example, if you combine them, you've at least partially addressed the baroqueness problem, although you still have this question of why there are the extra generations, for example. That is not explained. Robbie's question. You have, at least partially, by combining them, made the free parameter situation better, although still not completely. And furthermore, you have still partially solved the fine-tuning problem. And there's actually one other thing that happens, and that is that these theories together lend strength to one another in the sense that these lines didn't quite meet in the absence of supersymmetry, but now they meet to very high degree of precision if you assume that there is supersymmetry. So the combined theories are stronger than the separate parts, and that leads us to believe we might be on the right track. Now, gravity, on the other hand, is still left out in the cold, and we haven't said anything about that. And this is really probably the most difficult problem and one we have to face. And the idea, the thinking is that to really address the problems of gravity, we need a fundamentally new idea. And the fundamentally new idea that many of us in the field have been pursuing is that, is the following. We'll need a little more space there. Suppose you take your electron and you blow it up even further by a huge factor to distance scales of order 10 to the minus 32 centimeters. And on such distance scales, you might imagine the electron is no longer no longer point-like, but is instead a one-dimensional object or string, a filamentary loop of energy. Now, in the biophysics program, you certainly think about string-like things, but I'd like to contrast these strings with those. These are you sort of capture the essence of stringiness. For example, they have no bending rigidity. They're completely floppy, and they don't stick to each other. They don't stick. They're just the essence of stringiness. And in fact, this fact that the interactions of these are very simple is one of the features of string theory, namely that there's essentially a unique interaction between strings, namely a string can come along.
Is there a line tension in the string?
There is tension.
Yeah, why don't this be?
Tension does not mean
gravitational interaction.
Well, I'm about to describe how we get the gravitational interaction, so we'll get to that. Okay, so you can imagine a string coming along, and about the only thing that can happen, well, the only thing for closed strings, is that the string can split into two strings, like that. So I'm graphing what happens as a function of time, and there is a probability for that to happen, just like the coupling constant over here. And then, of course, you can have the time reverse of this process where two strings join, and that's it. Another feature of string theory is that if you consider the different states of motion of the string, a string is a more complicated object, you can actually get out, depending on how the string is moving, fermions, the gauge bosons, and most importantly, the graviton. All of these objects come out as different motions of these elementary string objects. Another feature of string theory is that string theory really predicts these larger symmetry structures needed for grand unification. Those naturally come out of the theory. I guess I should stop going down probably before now. So I'll continue up here. Another feature is that strings, so guts are naturally part of the scheme. Another feature is that this symmetry between bosons and fermions, supersymmetry, is essentially required for consistency of the theory. In fact, in the West, that is how supersymmetry was discovered, is in string theory. Finally, another feature is that string theory predicts its own dimension. But the dimension comes out to be 9 spatial dimensions plus 1 time, so we usually say 10. So you might say, well, that isn't a feature, that's a bug. But that's before you know about the next concept I'm going to explain, which goes by the name of compactification. So let's imagine taking a cylindrical object, say a soda straw. Let's imagine that on that soda straw is walking an ITP ant, like many of you see in your offices. That ITP ant can go in two different directions. It can go around or along, but if you imagine shrinking the radius of the straw down to a very small size, eventually you'll be in a situation where the ITP ant, or just ant, let's be nice, the ant cannot resolve that extra dimension and effectively sees that it can only walk in one dimension, not in two. So this is the notion of compactification, and the basic idea is that space, well, the 9 dimensions of space-time are like this. We have this 3 spatial dimensions, and for each point in these 3 spatial dimensions, there's some complicated but small internal space, and that's a 6-dimensional space, and the idea is that this is very analogous to the picture I just drew with the ant, and that we cannot see the 6-dimensional internal space. The simplest example of these things are known as Calabi-Yau manifolds. Okay, and this picture allows us to turn this bug actually into a feature for the following reason. Actually, there are various features of this scenario. First of all, strings can move not only in the three dimensions, but in the extra six dimensions. And so there are different states of that six-dimensional motion. And those, depending on those different states of six-dimensional motion, we can get things that appear to behave differently in three dimensions. In other words, it turns out we can answer Robbie's question, who ordered the muon? This implies the existence of the different generations. The different states of six-dimensional motion give you the different generations. So we've actually explained something. Another thing that these scenarios can naturally predict is how the grand unified symmetry gets broken, so that we have the observed asymmetry between the different forces with different strengths. This kind of scenario can also predict essentially all of these free parameters we were worried about. Once you know what this manifold is. And then finally, another possible feature, which has been discussed quite a lot recently, is that these extra dimensions may even be large enough that we're on the verge of observing them. And that would be incredibly exciting.
The number of dimensions that you compactified, has any bearing on the number of generations that you generate?
There's not a direct map. It turns out that it's certain topological quantities of this space that determine the number of generations. So it's not, it of course depends on the dimension, but it depends on a lot of other data too, like you know, how many holes there are, roughly speaking, the topology. Okay, so coming back to our table, we have string theory, and we've at least partially solved, well, no, essentially you solved the Baroqueness problem. We have a single unique object, or almost unique object. I'll come back to that. The theory is very simple. We've partially solved the free parameters problem and the fine-tuning problems, partially because we still have to figure out what this manifold is for number two, and for number three, we've still got the problem of supersymmetry breaking to confront. And also we've partially solved this problem. String theory resolves these nasty divergences. We've still got to figure out what it says about black holes in cosmology. So string theory is a nearly unique theory. The fact that the interaction is just this geometrical joining and splitting tells you you can't just do anything. But yet there are still some significant challenges.
What's the difference between a check mark and a P?
P is partial.
Oh, okay.
Partial, it's not, okay. I don't know. So maybe there's a better name. So check is, that's essentially, mm-hmm. It's a very simple theory, string theory. Okay. There still remain some very important challenges, however. And one is that, okay, string theory is nearly unique, but it's not quite unique. There are, in fact, five different string theories. So that's pretty close. We don't have infinitely many like grand unified theories. But there are five different string theories, and I can't describe to you the detailed differences. They have to do with mathematical structure, but there are basically four closed string theories that go by the name of the type 2A and 2B strings, and then the heterotic E8 cross E8 string and SO32 string. And then you can also have strings that have ends, and these go by the name of the type 1 strings. So that's one challenge. Another challenge is figuring out which compactification space to use here. in order that we can, say, compute all these parameters and so on. And then, of course, another set of challenges is to really nail down these two points, both this residual fine-tuning problem and understanding what string theory has to say about gravity on the conceptual level. Okay, so far I have outlined the status of string theory as it stood roughly before 1995.
Does string theory really predict fringe generations, or just is it more vague?
Well, it depends on what this manifold is. So it comes back to this problem, which how those extra six dimensions curl up. There are some ways that predict three generations, but if it's some other space, then you get a different number of generations. So clearly we want to figure out...
Nobody would be worried if it's more than three.
Well, yes, they would be worried, because we know that there are three light generations, right. And if there are other generations, they're very different from the generations we know. So you would have some more explaining to do. Okay, so in the post-95 era, there have been some additions to this story, which I'd like to talk about. And the first is that of T-duality. So let's come back to this picture I just erased, where the ant was walking along the cylinder. And let's consider motion of strings on such a cylinder. So if you have a string, let me say there are two kinds of states of motion that, two kinds of string states on such a space. You can have a string that is moving around the space. And so these are what I'll call momentum states. They get their energy because of the momentum of the string going around. And if you have a compact space like that, then that momentum is quantized in quantum mechanics, because basically you have to have an integral number of wavelengths going around the circle. And so that momentum is quantized in units of the radius of this space. So n is an integer. That's one of the kinds of states you can have, and that would also be true for particles. But there's another kind of state you can have, because these things are strings. Namely, you can have a winding state, where the string actually winds around the space, and those have an energy which, of course, grows with r, and then there's a term proportional to the tension of the string, and then another integer, depending on how many times the string winds.
Do you need to invoke quantum mechanics here? I suppose this should provide quantum mechanics.
That's certainly a possibility that has occurred to people, is that you might somehow derive quantum mechanics from these higher symmetries of string theory. That's a very interesting point, which we will see. We're not there yet. But at this level, we did need to invoke it to explain why these are quantized. Actually, I have to tell you about the symmetry before you could derive quantum mechanics. If you look at these two formulas, there is an apparent symmetry. Namely, we can exchange r goes to 1 over r times the tension, and n and m. And these formulas go over into one another. The energies of these two states exchange. Now, that sounds pretty preposterous, that somehow there could be a symmetry between strings that are moving around the circle and winding around the circle. But it's true in string theory. All the interactions of string theory respect this symmetry. So it's preposterous but true, and we need to think about its consequences. Actually, let me come back over here. Okay, so we imagine, for example, that we start out with a space with a pretty big radius and a string moving on that space, and then we can imagine shrinking the radius to make it smaller and smaller. And we have our string moving. And so the consequence of this symmetry is that there is an equivalent description of this small radius cylinder in terms of a large radius cylinder. With strings moving on that, with closed strings moving on that. This is this map, R goes to 1 over R. Small cylinders get mapped to large ones. Okay, so that's this.
Upper limit for the radius of
this
cylinder?
No, we can take this to infinity. We just go over to the new variables where it looks like a big cylinder, and it's a perfectly sensible thing, and we just take the radius off to infinity. And it looks just like this picture if we took the radius off to infinity in that direction. Okay, so that's the story for closed strings propagating on these things, but there's a slightly different story for these open strings that I mentioned. So consider an open string moving here, and the stuff of, in the middle of the string is just like the stuff of the closed string, so it sees this extra dimension open up, but the ends of the string are like the ant. They're really there's no reason for them to see an extra dimension, and in fact you've lost a dimension in which the ends of the string can move. So over in this picture you must have some object on which, well, with one less dimension which the string ends end on. That object is called a D-brain. So that's a natural consequence of this so-called T-duality. This one R goes to 1 over R map. And if you carry out this T-duality, if you iterate on various of the dimensions, you learn that you have to have these lower dimensional objects in all different dimensionalities. So you have a zero brain, a one brain, or D string, and so on, all the way up to nine-dimensional brains. So that's a pretty important revelation in the theory, essentially discovered by our own Joe Polchinski. And it has some pluses and minuses. On the minus side, now we've got all kinds of new states we have to think about. The theory is not looking so simple anymore. It's much more complicated. It's not a theory of just strings. On the plus side, this symmetry, this T-duality, relates some of the different known string theories. For example, we find a relation between the type 2A and 2B string. So they're really just different aspects of the same theory. Likewise, there's a relation between the two heterotic strings. Okay, so now...
Obviously, I thought in 2A and 2B, you don't have open strings.
Yeah, you don't. That's right. So you just follow. So you start with a closed string here, and then you, on say a large radius surface, and then you take it to small radius, and you discover that in the dual description over here, the large radius description of small radius, it's a 2B string. So that's independent of the existence of D brains. That just depends on this R goes to 1 over R symmetry and how it acts on this, on the theory, on the string theory. Does that make sense? It's the relation is independent of anything having to do with open strings. Okay, so we have new states, but we also have some new relations. Now I'd like to describe another symmetry, which is known as S-duality. And S-duality, one way of thinking about it is to look at these zero brain states, and in particular look at the masses of those. And you have, it turns out, zero brain states of all different charges. They have a quantized charge, somewhat like the electrical charge. You can have D particle states of various charges, but the mass also goes like...
These are states of what? Of the open string?
No. They're a new kind, it's like discovering a new particle, almost, in essence. You're discovering a new kind of object that is implied by the structure of the theory. Yeah, the D-brain. It's a new kind of object. It's not clear if you could make those out of strings. In fact, they carry a charge not carried by strings. Okay, so let's look at the D0 brains. They have masses that go like 1 over this string coupling constant. Now, another important fact in string theory is that this coupling strength, the probability for strings to split, is a dynamical variable. It's the value of a field, and so we can imagine changing it. It's a field known as the dilaton field. And so in particular, we can imagine adjusting this value and taking it off to infinity. Now, ordinarily, when you take a coupling constant to infinity, you get pretty worried that you might be getting out garbage or something that you can't describe. But this supersymmetry is a very powerful constraint, and so you actually trust this formula even in this limit. And what you see in this limit is the states are getting spaced more and more closely together, and in the limit you have a continuum of states. Coming out. And in general, when you have an infinite number of particle states with a given mass, say here zero mass, it's pretty hard to see how to make sense of such a theory. But this particular kind of continuum is the kind of continuum we've seen before. I've erased the formula, but that looks just like the formula for the different states corresponding to different momenta of an object moving on a circle. So it's so the easiest way to make sense of this spectrum of states is that there is an extra dimension emerging, and that 10 dimensions is now becoming 11. We've discovered yet another dimension with the identification that the radius of the 11th dimension goes like the string coupling constant. So this is one of the consequences of sort of a new symmetry involving relating strong and weak coupling. You can also relate the heterotic string and the type 1 string in a way that I don't have time to explain. But the bottom line is that we have a very interesting result. Several interesting results. First of all, we have enough symmetries now so that we can relate all of the 5 different string theories. They're all aspects of the same underlying theory. We've also discovered in the process this limit where 10-dimensional string theory becomes a different kind of 11-dimensional theory. And finally, we've discovered in this process many new states beyond strings. The so-called D-brains. And so there's some theoretical structure that we're just beginning to unearth and that encompasses all of this, but that we don't yet know all of the details of. And this theoretical structure goes by the name of M-theory. At least that's one possible name for it. And it turns out that I've gone through this relatively rapidly, but there are a number of different consistency checks of this whole structure. It fits together quite intricately and tightly. And it has also some successes. For example, it tells you how to give a way of counting the number of microscopic states inside a black hole. And so we really strongly believe that there is some sensible underlying theory here, part of the story of which is strings, and we're trying to unearth that theory. Now, this plethora of riches, however, in particular, is kind of troubling, that now we have not just strings, but D-brains. We've got too many different kinds of objects in the theory. And so this leads to the notion that we should carry the reductionist line of thinking one step further and you know, figure out some fundamental constituent. So in fact, one of the things that we really need, one of the outstanding questions, or well, two of the most important questions at this moment, is what are the fundamental degrees of freedom of the theory, and then what is the fundamental dynamics of the theory? And those are two questions that we're that are at least part of the discussion taking place at this workshop. Now, I'm pretty close to being out of time. I do have, well, if there's time to carry on, I could take a few more minutes to explain two of the ideas behind what these things are made out of. Should I carry on for a few more minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I should easily be able to finish in that time. Okay, so we've got this question of figuring out what M theory is, and there we really don't know, but we have some proposals. And one of the proposals is that M stands for matrix. Let me explain why this is true. One possibility is that the fundamental object in this theory is the simplest brain, namely the D0 brain or D particle. That those are the fundamental objects. Now you might say, well, does this mean you've come full circle and you're back to a theory of just particles, which is what you tried to get away from in the first place? The answer to that is no. These things are very strange objects for the following reason. If we describe a configuration of, say, n D brains, we need the following information to describe them. First of all, we need to specify the positions of those n D brains. So there are the position coordinates, one out of 10 or whatever of the position coordinates for the D particles. But there's one other piece of information we have to supply. For any pair of D particles, it turns out there can be in essence a straight string state, a minimal straight string state connecting them. And as part of specifying this configuration of D brains, we really need to specify what that state is doing. And that specification comes about through giving off-diagonal elements in this matrix. So really, in specifying a configuration of n D0 brains, or D particles, we need a full n by n matrix. Now, there is a sense in which you can build up the other structures of M theory from these D0 brains. For example, loosely speaking, you can get strings by stringing together a series of these D0 brains. Roughly. And likewise, you can get, for example, D2 brains by stringing together a collection of D0 brains in a different way. Something like this. This is very much a cartoon. So you can get the other objects out of, more or less, out of string theory. There are still some very significant puzzles here, but it looks like you might be on the right track. If this is a fundamental theory, though, or a fundamental proposal for, or is the fundamental underlying explanation of what M theory is, it leads to a rather radical consequence that I should point out, and that comes from the basic structure of matrices. If you multiply two matrices and multiply them in the opposite order, you get a different answer. So what we have here in describing these D particles is a generalization of the structure of space and time that is so-called non-commutative. It matters what order you multiply things in. And so there are various related related developments that have been emerging in recent times. Okay, so that's just a an outline of the matrix proposal, let me just quickly go through another proposal for how you define, how you might define M-theory. And this is the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence. Let's consider a collection of these D3 brains. And just like in the case of the D0 brains, you can have strings that connect the various D3 brains, as well as ending having both ends on a single D3 brain. And if you look at the low energy description of this configuration, the low energy description of that is that, well, these string states essentially behave as gauge bosons. That's how we got out gauge theory in the first place in string theory. Here we're just doing it on this restricted space of strings ending on D3 brains. So this becomes a gauge theory, but no longer a gauge theory in 10 dimensions because the ends are confined to a three-dimensional space. So it's a gauge theory in 4 space-time dimensions. Now, on the other hand, it was mentioned earlier that brains should have a gravitational field. Someone pointed that out to me. So there's an equivalent description of this. So these brains are heavy things. They create a gravitational field. In Einstein's general relativity, gravitation is curvature of space-time. So there's an equivalent picture of these things as a curved space-time. And the picture that results looks somewhat to me like, well, like a crevasse in a glacier. So schematically, you have this sort of slot-like structure. And the D3 brains are, in the gravitational description, are down at the bottom of the crevasse. And this curved space, in the limit where you go very close to the D3 brains, has a name. It's known as anti-de Sitter space. It's a very special kind of space, or space-time. And in this context, it's a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. There are the 3+1 directions, the three spatial directions along the brains, the time direction, and then the radial direction transverse to the three brains. And so from the observation that this basic configuration has two different descriptions, Maldacena made the following proposal. Namely, that string theory, or M theory, moving on this anti-de Sitter space is equivalent to gauge theory. In this case, this four-dimensional gauge theory in the alternate description of this stack of D3 brains. And so that's very interesting. In fact, you could imagine getting out string theory in flat space by taking the limit where you have a very large number of these D3 brains, so you have a very heavy configuration. And in that limit, in the n goes to, number of brains goes to infinity limit, you effectively get infinite radius of curvature here, so you can, there's a limit where you get out string theory in flat space. Now, where I want to close is actually on this subject, and I want to point out that this is a very radical proposal if carried to its natural end. Because here we have a relationship between string theory in, say, 4+1 dimensions. Turns out that the five extra dimensions are really there. They just sort of go along for the ride in this argument. You have string theory in 4+1 dimensions equivalent to a gauge theory in 3+1 dimensions. And the idea that you can do this, that you can have an equivalence between theories that changes the dimension, is very strange. This is known as a holographic proposal. It's like saying that you and I and everything going on in this room can be described, given an equivalent description, in terms of states that just live on the walls of this room. Very weird how you can get a sort of local looking theory out of that. But it turns out that this holographic proposal is just what the doctor ordered for one of the deep paradoxes in this last unsolved problem of the last century, namely that of quantum gravity. We most sharply confront the problem of quantum gravity in dealing with what happens to information cast into a black hole. And in trying to find out a way out of the resulting paradoxes, in a way, the most palatable proposal is that nature or physics really is holographic in a sense, very much like this. So here, in a sense, holography comes out. And in black hole physics, in resolving some of those deep puzzles, we needed holography. So that's another hint that perhaps we're really on the right track towards understanding something very fundamental and very weird indeed. If you thought quantum mechanics was weird, just wait. Okay, so one of the other subjects of this conference is studying the implications of holography to both the black hole problems and to cosmology. So I'd better stop there, but I'll say that we're just beginning to unearth the fundamental structure of this theory and see some highly unusual and interesting consequences of M-theory. And that, in a nutshell, is what our workshop is working on. So, thanks. Any more questions? Yes.
Does it explain why there's only one time?
Not necessarily. In a sense, for consistency, it's hard to imagine something with more times. It's hard to cook up an example where you really have a sensible theory with more time.
In what sense is this less baroque than what you
started? Say if it's matrix theory, that's one simple, you just have these D0 brains. They have a rather interesting looking description, but it's a very simple mathematical structure. But it does look like we've regressed in a sense because things are looking more baroque, but it's clear that we're just looking at different pieces of a very symmetric structure and we're just not looking at it right.
What are the calculational tools? You do quantum mechanics, you have a wave function, Hamiltonian, you have quantum field theory actions, field amplitudes.
Yeah.
You have no feeling for what.
Yeah, I didn't write down any of those, of course, because there are biologists in the audience. But anyway, here you would have an action, it turns out. There's an action describing matrix theory and a wave function and so on. But really, when we go to the deeper level, to the really most symmetric, most fundamental description of the whole theory, it's not clear what the right mathematical structures are. For example, it's been hard to write down something that looks like an action for the whole theory that really makes sense. And in fact, in some sense, in string theory, we can just compute so-called on-shell things, like the S matrix, and not sort of the action for off-shell configuration. So it's not clear. We're sort of having to figure out the rules as we go.
Do you have some sort of quantization rule for the string as well?
Quantization rule. Like, there are a number of quantization rules that are relevant. For example, a string carries a certain kind of charge, and that charge is quantized.
Where do they come from?
So this comes back to the idea of deriving quantum mechanics. At some level, the theory is sort of quantum mechanical, and that is, in some sense, an input into how the theory is formulated. But there is this fantasy or possibility in the field that you might actually see quantum mechanics as output from some more fundamental set of assumptions. It's something we'd like. Well, it'd be very interesting to see, but we have not yet figured out how that happens, although we have some rough ideas based upon one way of saying what quantum mechanics is in string theory is that we have, say, if we're looking at scattering of two strings, we can have a diagram where they come together, join for a while, and then split, and that has the topology of a sphere with four points removed. And then there are quantum mechanical corrections to that, which involve so-called higher genus surfaces, where you have a loop in the middle. And these enter in a very on a very similar footing in string theory. And here's the classical amplitude, and here's the quantum correction. In some sense, maybe you can derive the whole thing from some simpler structure and somehow predict quantum mechanics. But that's, you know, there are various ideas like this tossed around, but it's not seen cleanly where how that would work.
What is the connection of the theory to experiment?
There are aspects of what aspects of string theory that, in a sense, are accessible to experiment, like supersymmetry. On the other hand, you might say, well, maybe there's some other realization of supersymmetry. We may just have seen supersymmetry. Really, seeing that nature is stringy is a difficult problem. Although there are new experimentally, although there are new ideas in that vein too, because it's just possible that string theory may be realized with the extra dimensions being large enough that those dimensions might start to be observable in imaginable accelerators. Now, that's not necessarily, that's not a prediction of string theory, I want to be clear, but it's a possibility. And if something like that happens, we could have, you know, some really astounding things to learn about around the corner. So, but it's true. We are a ways off from really knowing we can do stringy experiments. But in addition, we have some very important guides in terms of its ability to handle gravity and other aspects. So I'll leave it at that.
Thanks. So.